This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 240-horsepower turbocharged Acura RDX. More at acura.com/RDX.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business? You think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really gotta rap and be all that. But prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, a frank talk with Christine Bishan, one of the biggest names in little films. Then, the Latin American telenovela crosses our borders. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Don't go anywhere. It's The Business from NPR. We'll talk more about the Latin American soap opera known as the telenovela later in the show. But first, an actual Mexican standoff between America's Spanish-language broadcaster, Telemundo, and Mexico's second-largest network, TV Azteca. Telemundo had just finished filming a reality show called Quinceañero a week ago when dozens of armed Mexican police crashed the party, replete with bulletproof vests and shotguns, bringing up the rear lawyers from TV Azteca. In a plotline fit for a soap, Azteca says it's just enforcing a court order to shut down production because Telemundo's partner on the show is under exclusive contract to them. But predictably, Telemundo's American parents, NBC Universal, see the move a little differently, as a despotic effort by Azteca's billionaire owner, Ricardo Salinas Pliego, to keep those pesky gringos at bay. The raid against Telemundo came only a day after Telemundo asked Mexico's government for a license to set up a national TV network to compete with TV Azteca. Elsewhere, mobile ESPN, the year-old cell phone company backed by Disney, is hanging up and hoping to reinvent itself as a content supplier for bigger wireless carriers. It seems widescreen TV-loving sports fanatics didn't want to ditch their old cell phones and then buy new ones just to watch a big game on a screen the size of a postage stamp. Meanwhile, some additional snafus in melding old media with new. Fox Broadcasting said last week it was looking into whether clips from The Simpsons and Family Guy, placed by average folks on Google Video, unwittingly put Google in violation of their content sharing agreement with News Corp. Such disarray imperils the $900 million deal between the companies recently inked. In August, Google won the right to supply News Corp's MySpace, with 200 million users, with search features and advertising. As CBS MarketWatch put it so aptly, Google's showing how little control it has over its own features. And the problems are likely to be magnified, because Google's recently unveiled a feature that allows users to post Google videos much more easily to MySpace-created web pages. In other words, if Fox wanted The Simpsons on MySpace, they'd have put it there themselves, thank you very much. Finally, the upcoming Fox film Borat, Cultural Learnings of America for Make Benefit Glorious Nation of Kazakhstan, stars Sacha Baron Cohen in his popular role as the faux Kazakh correspondent. Everyone gets the joke, it seems, except Kazakhstan. Deeply nervous about its national image, the government of Kazakhstan took out a pricey 4-page color ad in the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune last week. According to TMZ.com, the special insert, entitled Kazakhstan in the 21st Century, features a photo of the country's president, Nursultan Nazarbayev, on its front page shaking hands with President George W. Bush. And it contains articles like Transforming the Mixed Blessing of a Nuclear Legacy. TMZ estimates the ad likely costs somewhere between $300,000 and $400,000 to run. Kazakhstan's per capita income was approximately $7,500, according to 2004 estimates. This is so absurd, we are praying that it's a publicity stunt by Fox to promote the Borat film. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later on the show, soap operas with a Spanish accent. But next, an indie film producer's killer life. For the past 20 years, Christine Bishan's New York-based company, Killer Films, has been producing indies that were 180 degrees from Hollywood. Edgy fare like Larry Clark's Kids and Todd Solondz's Happiness, to Oscar bait like Far From Heaven and Boys Don't Cry. In 1998, Bishan wrote a highly regarded How to Produce Indies book with Slate film critic David Edelstein called Shooting to Kill. almost a decade later, she's written a new hybrid book, part memoir, part primer, filled with the train wrecks and triumphs from her recent years making indies. And a handful of studio films, too. The book is A Killer Life, How an Independent Film Producer Survives Deals and Disasters in Hollywood and Beyond. Christine Vachon, welcome to the business.
My pleasure.
The business has changed so much since you wrote your first book. First of all, let's talk about how the business has changed since you wrote that book. How has it changed?
The way the business has changed, there's so many different answers to that question. And I'll start with, in some ways, the most obvious, which is, you know, people don't make films on film so much anymore. And that really had not started happening when I wrote the first book. And now I think this past year at Sundance, I believe there were more movies not shot on film than there were shot on film.
And because of that, I mean, it's more than just a different medium being employed. I mean, the result of this is what? I mean, basically the barrier to entry changes, right?
Yes, the barrier to entry changes, and that means that access is far more unlimited than it ever was.
Mm-hmm.
So, which, you know, is a double-edged sword. It means that, you know, that the whole notion that anybody can, you know, go out there with, you know, with a camera, you know, a video camera that they bought themselves or whatever you want to call it these days, and make their own stories, it's true. And some of those stories do go all the way. I also feel there's so much more now, obviously, with television. Television has become a much stronger draw for independent films. I mean, a lot of movies used to say, or I should say their creators used to say, you know, I want a theatrical release. That's the holy grail. And that is absolutely, I'm not going to settle for anything less. But in fact, going right to television and having a very strong cable premiere certainly assures that more people will see your film than in a very limited theatrical release.
You're listening to The Business. We're talking with Christine Vachon, the founder of the cutting-edge indie film factory Killer Films and the producer of movies like Boys Don't Cry and Far From Heaven. The book is A Killer Life, How an Independent Film Producer Survives Deals and Disasters in Hollywood and Beyond.
The book is great, and it sort of goes down 100 streets simultaneously. And I wonder, you know, there's no real narrative thread through it. It's sort of, you know, this area and this area and this area and this area. And I guess that's emblematic of what producing is in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Is that why you're a producer and not a director?
Well, I mean, I guess the short answer to that is I can guarantee you I'm a much better producer than I would be a director. But I do think that you know, there's certainly a large element of producing which is all about insane multitasking. You know, I mean, producers are really suited for this age where, you know, everyone has one hand on a BlackBerry and another hand on their cell phone and and all of that. It really it works for a strong producer's personality. You know, but I also feel like it's a different set of skills. I mean, a director has to be so focused on the small picture at all times when they're actually trying to get the best out of the actors, the best out of the production design, the best out of the camera. And a producer needs to be focused on the big picture at all times. And I'm just more of a big picture person.
Now, I want to talk about the process. I want to talk about the money in a second. But let's actually get to the money first of all. If money were no object, I guess the question I'm interested most in asking you is, would making movies get easier and would they be any better?
You know, I think you can't divorce filmmaking from the fact that money is an object. I mean, it's a commercial art form, and I have to say, in countries that rely heavily on subsidies to support their art film, you know, habits, I don't think the movies are as good. I really don't, with few exceptions. You know, because there's not that same drive that, yes, you have to find something to say that is relevant to you, that you're passionate about, et cetera. But at the same time, it has to warrant an audience's interest.
So it's sort of like, you know, if that premise were true, every open mic night at every bar in America would be the best entertainment value you could possibly find, right?
Right. I mean, I think that they're so wrapped up together. And I don't think there's a film director in the world, no matter who they are, you know, no matter how much money they've made, that doesn't have to deal with the wall of the budget. It's just part of the process.
Mm-hmm. You're a person who, as a function of success and hard work, has started to have very big stars be interested in being in your movies. You've got Infamous coming out, which is a Truman Capote movie. Sandra Bullock is in it. Talk a little bit about that.
Okay, so Doug McGrath, who had previously directed Nicholas Nickleby and Gwyneth Paltrow's first film, Emma, was obviously not an untested director by any means. And the fact that Julia Roberts' agent got a hold of our script, I think Doug was just newly represented by CAA at the time. I think he read it and immediately thought, this is exactly the kind of part that is perfect for a star who wants to stretch a little, you know, because she's not carrying the whole movie, but she gets to play a really meaty part in a fantastic ensemble.
If I'm not mistaken, they had just signed Julia Roberts.
Yes, they had.
And do you ever feel like, as sort of the, you know, well, you know, she's that crazy producer from New York with the combat boots. Do you feel used to sort of, you know, be the pony show of, you know, and these are the interesting people you can work with?
You know what?
I think they get paid in vegetable sprouts.
It's a mutual use.
Yeah.
So I don't begrudge it at all. If that's what we are, if we're the, you know, the indie side show that they bring out to prove to the stars that even though, you know, they have access to Spielberg and Ron Howard, but also to us, that's fine with me as long as we keep getting the actors.
In the book, you say something which I think is interesting, which is money has a personality. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, these days, films get – or the kind of – I should say the films that I make, so-called independent films, get funded in more variety of ways than they ever did. We still do sometimes take a movie, you know, right to a studio and get it fully financed there. But more often than not, we're putting together a combination of North American money, some kind of equity that's, you know, either against North America or against the world or what have you, often a foreign sales element. All you know, film financing has really been invaded to some degree by a lot of new equity financiers. And on the positive side, it helps offset the risk. So it means a studio might enter into one of our films that's, you know, got slightly edgier subject matter, for example, in a way that they wouldn't have before because they've got partners. But all of those entities do have personalities, and that in order to keep the money happy and also to manage everyone's expectations – for example, there are equity financiers who, you know, want to be extremely involved in the creative process of making the film. For some filmmakers, that's a disaster. For other filmmakers, that's just fine. Of course, sometimes you don't have a choice.
That brings us to the next interesting factoid about money, at least according to Christine Vachon, and that is never put your own money in.
And except sometimes you have to.
Except sometimes, yes. Yeah, with the caveat that except sometimes you have to. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that ultimately it's sort of – I mean, I have worked with producer financiers, you know, people who get producing credits on the film and take a creative interest in the movie but are also financing the movie. And it's an intrinsic conflict of interest because you can't – it's hard to think with your heart and your head. That's really what it comes down to. For example, in Boys Don't Cry, Kimberly's dream was to have that Boston song, More Than a Feeling, that to have that be the song that they're skating to in the roller rink. I can't remember exactly what the price was, but it was something outrageous, like $500,000. No negotiation, you know, end of discussion. So needless to say, it is not in the movie. But it does beg the question, of course she really wanted it, like – in those cases, that's an extreme example because the song was so expensive.
We should point out the whole movie was made for how much?
About 2.2, I think, 2.3 in
right.
That area. So yes, it would have been a quarter of the film's budget.
Yeah.
But that's an extreme example. But let's say it had been $50,000, okay? So would that mean that the movie would have made $50,000 more at the box office? Like actually, if you had asked me at the time, Would the song More Than a Feeling have been worth $50,000? I would have said yes.
Let's talk about directors for a second. You have a fairly simple director's quiz.
Okay, the number one criteria on the director's quiz is, are you able, director, to sustain or have you sustained a relationship in your life with a mammal? And it doesn't have to be romantic, because this can often apply to, sometimes directors come to us with longtime producing partners. And I try to respect those relationships as much as possible and hope, you know, and karmically in turn, my relationships with my long-term directors will be respected too if they, you know, if some other movie gets handed to them, you know, from somewhere else. I just think the ability to maintain a relationship does reflect, has an ability to reflect how one will and will not be able to handle the inherent relationships and dramas that happen on a film set.
So we're talking here not about relationships with Fido, but hominids, and hopefully.
Right.
But have you ever missed the signs, and have you hired them anyway, even if you if they did fail the quiz, and what happened then?
I've learned over the years. I've learned that there are simply some directors that are on the life is too short list, and there's some directors I was very happy to have worked with once, don't have to work with again. I know what you're referring to is in the book. I talk specifically about a very bad experience, and I don't name the director. And the one thing I will say about that experience, and I still won't name him, is afterwards, the producer of the movie he had made before mine said to me, now who I had called up, we had called him up and said, so how was it to work with director X?
To vet the candidate,
yes.
So to speak.
And he said, oh, he's great. He's great. He's so talented. So after this happened, I ran into, you know, producer number one, and he said, oh, my God, I feel so terrible. I should have told you. And I said, well, why didn't you? He said, I just thought maybe he'd be different.
Was it a compliment? Like, he'd be different with you because
you're
used to herding cats and sort of dealing with this kind of stuff?
Nobody wants to prevent somebody from working. Nobody wants to do that, you know? It's an awful thing to do. And even though I will come off movies sometimes furious with, you know, a costume designer who went over budget or a production designer who I felt wasn't as effective as they should have been, when push comes to shove and people call for references on them, I usually, you know, I try to be honest but fair to them, because often the circumstances of a movie really, you know, can affect, you know, people's state of mind. That said, given what we went through with Director X, I would never not warn another producer about it.
You write that one of the reasons why you haven't sold out is that nobody's ever asked you. And, you know, assuming you had a price and it could be named and you did sell out, what would you be giving up and what would you be getting? Do you get the house in the Hollywood Hills but not the ability to make Boys Don't Cry?
I don't really know the answer, because I've never worked for anybody but me. So it's hard to know what it would be like. And I wouldn't have a house in the Hollywood Hills anyway.
You're more of an Echo Park kind of person.
I'm more of a New York City kind of person. I can't drive.
They're buses. Christine Vachon will not ride the bus. She's the author of A Killer Life, How an Independent Film Producer Survives Deals and Disasters in Hollywood and Beyond. Christine, thanks for being on The Business.
My pleasure.
Christine Vachon's latest film is Infamous, a new look at Truman Capote during the time he was writing In Cold Blood. Infamous will be in theaters October 13th. You're listening to The Business. After a short break, love, Latin American style. This is NPR. We'll be right back. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business. Spanish-language soap operas known as telenovelas come in all colors and flavors, from cheap, sappy melodramas to sweeping, big-budget period pieces. But quintessentially, telenovelas are inexpensive half hours filled with beautiful people and love that will not be denied. Whether it's Pedro el Escamoso, that's Pedro the Scaly, or The Rich Also Cry, all you have to do is tune into your local Spanish-language TV station any evening, and you'll see what I mean.
Esta la prueba de tu traición, maldita. Una cara de dos diamante.
¿Diamante?
¿Soledad? ¿Estaba soñando con Soledad?
¡Habla, desgraciado!
In the last decade, the telenovela became an international phenomenon, and now the telenovela has reached our shores. Last month, two American TV networks debuted their anglicized versions of the telenovela. The business producer Matt Holtzman has more.
While the immigration debate goes on and on, Latin American television programs are infiltrating American airwaves. But before you call your congressman, you should know that while telenovelas are Latin American, their parents were American. Tomas Lopez Pumarejo works with a group that studies the world's Spanish and Portuguese television fiction industries.
It's an offspring of the radio soap operas, which Procter & Gamble and Lever Brothers adapted in different countries. Eventually, all that developed into telenovelas, but the primary model is that American model that came from the commercial broadcasting of the 1920s.
Telenovelas would go on to become bigger than their U.S. relatives.
That's the type of program that is watched the most all over the world because they're cheap to buy, because they're cheap to produce, and because they're easily understood across cultures.
There are lots of little differences, but soaps and telenovelas have one main difference.
Telenovelas, they end. There is a protagonist couple. When all the problems are over, they get married, and then that's the end of the show.
Today, while American-style soap operas are seen almost exclusively here and in Europe, telenovelas are wildly popular almost everywhere else around the world.
My mother-in-law, she cooks, she cleans, she takes care of the kids, but from 7 to 10, she goes in the room, she shuts the door, and she watches her novellas.
Paul Buccieri hopes you'll get just as hooked on the new English-language telenovelas he's producing. Two of the shows debuted early last month on many Fox TV stations.
Desire. One series, six nights a week, for 13 weeks of the story.
With their huge popularity in Latin America and a growing population of Americans with Latin American roots, the people at Fox sensed that the telenovela could be a real moneymaker in the States. They hired Paul Buccieri in 2005 to acquire a number of current and classic telenovelas and adapt them for American audiences. Paul and his crew started with scripts to the Colombian show Mesa para Tres and the Cuban show Salir de Noche. They whittled them down and made adjustments for cultural differences to create Desire and Fashion House.
In our Desire, the guys are running from the mob. In the Cuban version, they are running from a drug lord. I don't know if as many people are crying in our versions.
Fox was selling Desire and Fashion House into syndication when UPN and the WB announced they'd merge into the new CW network. Many Fox TV stations carried programming from the defunct networks and were suddenly left with giant holes in their schedules. They decided to pull the telenovelas from syndication and use them in primetime on their own quasi-network of stations called My Network TV. Suddenly, Paul Buccieri was producing a huge slate of shows, or what he refers to as arcs, and the fate of a network was on his shoulders.
It is a daunting challenge because originally we were designed for three arcs, 13 weeks each. That escalated to four arcs. That escalated to eight arcs, 52 weeks. So the production ramped up rapidly. It ramped up in less than, 5 months.
Paul Buccieri's offices in Los Angeles have been turned into a telenovela factory.
So this used to be our development department. Now it's filled with avid bays. Each editor has a different episode they cut. He's getting away. The day editors are done, a night crew comes in, and then they start cutting. So we go 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week here in this facility alone.
My TV network stations air episodes of Desire and Fashion House every weekday evening and a recap on Saturday evenings. To keep up with this and next season's shows, 9 production units in San Diego shoot simultaneously. Sources guess the cost of each episode at $200,000, which is hundreds of thousands less than typical primetime programming, but similar to American soap opera budgets. Ratings have been unimpressive since the shows went on the air September 5th, but Fox stations can afford to build audience because the telenovelas are so cheap. What will be interesting to see is what happens if the shows are a huge success. Remember, the difference between a soap and a telenovela is that telenovelas end.
Come December 4th, Fashion House and Desire are going to be gone, and Watch Over Me and Art of Betrayal are going to start. And I think in that, it makes them different than soaps. Also, we talk about in soaps, Susan Lucci, she's been on the same show and she does a wonderful job, but for gosh, over 20 years, you would never kill off a Susan Lucci character. With that, there's a sense of predictability. With our shows, there isn't that sense because some main characters don't make it through the entire arc.
The idea of killing off main characters or yanking a successful TV show off the air before it's been milked dry is positively un-American. Remember when Fonzie jumped the shark on his water skis on Happy Days? But given current ratings, Fox can only hope to have to cross that bridge.
I'm sure we'd find a way to bring back Fashion House. I'm sure we'd find a way to bring back Desire.
ABC is also dipping their toes in the telenovela pond, but in a totally different way, with Ugly Betty or Betty La Fea. It's the story of an ugly duckling who gets a job at a glamorous fashion magazine.
Hi, I'm a really big fan of yours. That travel layout you did with the tiki torches. Wow, that was really gorgeous.
Thank you.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of this Hiroki spread I'd seen a couple of years ago.
Listen, I don't know who you are or what you're implying, but I would never use another photographer's idea.
Oh, no. I wasn't saying... I should go.
Ugly Betty is the world's most popular telenovela, with subtitled versions in more than 50 countries. There are also local versions, like Russia's Born Ugly. And there's Nobody Like Jassy in India. Even the Colombian network that created Betty La Fea is making a new version. But the ABC show isn't so much a telenovela as a big-budget, once-a-week, no-end-in-sight, classic American-style TV program. And it's not the first time an American company has made a version of the show. The wildly popular Indian and Russian versions were produced by Sony Pictures International Television here in L.A. In fact, the division's president, Steve Kent, has worked on more than a few telenovelas in the last few years.
We wrote, using American and Russian writers, a novella called Poor Anastasia. And it was a period piece, and it was basically Romeo and Juliet with the czars and the serfs, and it took place in the late 1800s in St. Petersburg. And a huge success. It did so well on this network called CTC. And that show was the first Russian show to cross borders, and it's been sold in 15 countries outside of Russia, which was just amazing.
But not all of Sony's telenovelas have been hits.
I think the one that's our least successful didn't work because it followed Betty La Fea, and people were so upset that it was over that they refused to watch The Replacement. Every time a novella ends, it's hard-ish to get people to get into the habit of watching a new one because you got to learn who everybody is again, and it's work. And so I think a soap opera in some of the novella territories could be the next thing.
For The Business, I'm Matt Holzman.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com, keyword The Business. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio.